The mission lies in quite other fields, as you well know. Mia, this doesn't sound very kind, Sanjay's, and it also disappoints me that I should not take further pictures. During your absence I have bought me a film camera, because I wanted to get a movie of your ship. Sanjay's, your disappointment pities me. But the status should remain. Still, I will admit you're using the film camera, that you may be allowed to film my ship. But you are prohibited from doing this up close, and also you may not get me on your film. But I will give you a short demonstration of my ship. Mia, thank you. I could not film from near anyway, else the camera be destroyed. You had said earlier I could photograph your new ship up close. As you know, I tried this last contact, which failed because my camera, so to speak, exploded in my hands and fell, and the light measuring instrument and searcher were broken. I had to send it for expensive repair. Sanjay's, did this really happen? I am sorry, and I will make it up. That was not meant. In the ninth contact, which took place on Friday, the 21st of March 1975 in late afternoon, the discussion turned to the purpose of these contacts at this time and the ET's view of present Earth humanity. Sanjay's says, we are neither guardians of Earth beings nor God-sent angels or similar. Many persons suggest we are watching over Earth and her beings and would control their fates. This is not true, because we only perform a self-selected mission which has nothing to do with supervising or regulating Earth fates. Thus it is wrong to expose us as superterrestrial messengers and guardians. If we were such, we would regulate openly. So this is not true, because the Earth human goes his own evolutionary way. Surely, he is barbarous, and also impetuous in his research, and often unscrupulous. But barbarism is peculiar to many creatures, for it is natural conditioning and suited, thus life is assured. In this I speak of natural barbarism which is not degenerative. Such is also the character of more developed beings than Earth man and first ends at higher levels of spiritual development. It is not suited for the Earth being to be degraded for this. He is a descendant of wild ancestors and has to go the way of his evolution. This leads, through misery and troubles, towards cognition and knowledge. But this takes toughness and a certain barbarism, without which no inclination for a new better future takes place. At first a certain barbarism inspires research and development, because in this is strength to overcome confinements which obstruct progress. Earthman may recognize that he would not become liberated from sickness if life was not cut short by it, inspiring analysis of the sickness germs in the search for protective means. The risk life for exploratory purposes is necessary barbarism, which may be tolerated. Yet all kinds of evolution is barbaric, because that generates the necessary strength. A great danger is of scientists utilizing the power of their knowledge to beat their less developed fellow creatures into slavery and exploitation. From this they should be prevented, as well as their technical achievements which only serve for destruction. It is not in any best interest. They're setting themselves up as gods, and by this transmitting the same mistakes their forefathers already did. These influences we want to prevent. Still, we want to encourage certain cognitions and show certain ways. And when we interfere in certain matters, that is only so that Earth beings would not commit the same errors for which our forefathers so painfully suffered. Further on in the ninth contact, Sanjay's continues a chronology of Pleiadian recent history begun in the fifth contact, where she described their migration to the star group we call the Pleiades. She resumes now with one of their earlier arrivals in our solar system and on Earth. This history, though clearly beyond all documented records, is not entirely implausible and may even shed some light on other ancient accounts of early history of our humanity. Other phenomenal works such as A Haste by John Newbrew and Isis unveiled by Helena P. Blavatsky have described some of this in varying degree before, but perhaps not as succinctly. Sanjay's, at our fifth contact, we ended the history of our mankind where some 50,000 years ago in Earth chronology, our homeworlds found peace and liberty. Shortly before this time, 70,000 human beings fled the Pleiades, under the leadership of Pelagon. In spacecraft which they took by force, They fled through the cosmos and settled here on Earth. Under Pelagon were 200 subleaders, scientists, competent in special fields of knowledge. By these, and others, Pelagon was unanimously acknowledged as King of Wisdom, IHWH/God, and regarded as such. In the course of millenniums, they constructed great cities and inhabited all the continents of Earth. Regrettably, this went well for only a narrow 10,000 years, until desires for power and control prevailed once more, and a deadly war raged over all the Earth. Without exception, all was destroyed, and only a few thousand human beings survived, on Earth, while others fled once more into the cosmos and settled on faraway worlds. For 7,000 years, none returned to Earth, and the humans left behind degenerated and became completely wild. Then descendants of those who had settled on faraway worlds returned. They were again under the leadership of an IHWH, under whose command they built on Atlantis and Mu. They built huge cities on each of the two separate continents. For thousands of years they lived in friendship and peace, until a few scientists were again overcome by the old thirst for might and power, and tried to seize the government. But having tired of wars, the nations rose against them, and they occupied spaceships and fled into cosmic space, that being some 15,000 years ago in Earth chronology. For 2 millenniums, they and their descendants lived in a neighboring solar system. 2 millenniums during which they had become very evil and only maintained order under strictest control. By mutation and their sciences, they extend their lifespans to some thousands of years. Overcome by their thirst for power, they left their world about 13,000 years ago and returned to Earth. Their highest leader was the scientist Arras, who was also called the Barbarian. Like the IHWH 40,000 years before, he also had 200 leaders and subleaders, who were competent in special fields of sciences. In two groups, they settled the High North and the present Florida of North America, while they continuously attacked to Atlantis and Mu in wars. In only a few millenniums after their occupation of Earth bases, they succeeded in destroying the civilizations of Atlantis and Mu. The few survivors went into servitude, while many great scientists were able to flee, and return to their homeworlds in the Pleiades. But centuries before this point in time, the intruders boasted of their conquest of Earth, and the Ihuarus led a severe and bloody regime. Still, his subleaders assumed for themselves many things and became more and more independent. Within only 3 decades, they had gone far in their own decision-making, even though they feared the punishments of the IHWH Arras. They advocated a codex, to under all circumstances maintain their own race pure and not allow it to fall to mutations away from themselves. In a forbidden manner and secretly, they went out and caught wild Earth creatures and mutations who were distant descendants of former human beings from cosmic space. Wild and beautiful female beings were tamed and mated with by the leaders who called themselves Sons of Heaven. Each, according to his own race, created mutated beings, completely new forms of life, who were of dwarf-like stature, gigantic, or animal-like. Samjusa, the highest of the subleaders, mated with an Eva, a female being, who was still mostly human-like and also rather beautiful, in feature and form. The descendant of this act was of male sex and a human being of good form. Samjusa called him Adam, which was a word meaning earth human being. A similar breeding produced a female, and in later years they were mated to each other. Meanwhile, others similar had been produced, who forced groups and tribes. From these, present Earth mankind developed. IHWH, angered by those activities, seized his subleaders when he could catch them and killed or exiled them. In time he changed his mind and recognized a new power he could exercise over the Earth beings. With newly appointed subleaders and guard angels, he brought 3 human races under his control. These were the ancestors of those who today are known as Indians, then the fair-skinned inhabitants who had settled around the Black Sea, and the third were the Gypsies along the south of the Mediterranean Sea, who were called Hebrews. Through his guard angels, IHWH Arras subjugated those races and forced them under his control. As the highest ruler over them, he allowed himself to become venerated and adored. He allowed them to venerate him above creation itself, and his sub-leaders as assistant creators. He imposed harsh and severe laws demanding blood of the guilty. His son Ja'af, who took over his dominion, was little better, for he too as Ihwh demanded only blood and death from the three enslaved races. The later descendants of these gods became more humane and developed a degree of spirituality. Their spiritual evolution changed their minds and they decided to leave the development of the earth beings to their natural course, and retired to their homeworld, so they left the earth and returned as peaceful creatures to the Pleiades, where their own mankind had reached advanced states. United, we live together today and are an allied population in peace and liberty. This is the essential, that is important for earth beings to know. This was a stupendous statement, and not altogether unsupported. There is evidence of other great deadly wars fought on earth, even using atomic weapons in our far distant past, and almost inconceivably beyond our present age of science, which is actually less than 200 years old. The Takoti documents of Japan, which predate all other records there, and all records in the Western world, going back 24,000 years in unbroken history, the foundation of Shinto, support these claims of earlier man-made atomic devastation of this world. The Takoti documents, on which the ancient Shinto teachings and the old Kojiki history are based, describe a great worldwide atomic war in that distant past, and even contain maps showing the locations of each of the atomic blasts, and the cities destroyed. The symbol on those old maps which marks the sites of the blasts is a mushroom-shaped cloud. The Hindu Mahabharata describes still another great world atomic war that occurred about 8,000 years ago, which wiped out whole nations and vast armies and left total and complete devastation. It was to some of these sites that Askit took Mir in a trip into the past, to show him with his own eyes what man has done to himself. Is it possible that the Pleiadians now visiting Switzerland feel that they have vested interests here coming over from their own belligerent and often chaotic past, and perceiving yet another atomic devastation by the scientists' new ascendancy, a leg to us from their own history, now seek to head it off if possible? In the last of that contact, Mir was chastised for not getting this word out before it may be too late, and he objected that he was not a suitable one to do this, for which he was further rebuked and then offered some help in an attempt to make it easier for him. The Pleiadians had indicated to Mir that they could influence phenomena and could control events. They gave us adequate and convincing evidence of these capabilities on a number of occasions during our 8 years of investigations in this case. One time, in Europe on our way to Senior, we were picked up and taken to an interview with what we took to be a senior intelligence officer of a certain national government. During that interview, a multiple secured safe was opened and we were shown an object. Inside of that safe at that time, on a top shelf, laying flat, was a plain powder blue folder with an enclosure clip, and a signature sheet was fastened to the front. That folder was never touched or moved as we crouched in front of the opened safe. After viewing and inspecting the new object of interest, it was returned to a bag inside and the safe was carefully closed and locked, and the piece of furniture disguising it was returned to its normal appearance. That interview lasted several hours, and then we were taken back to our hotel, which was kept locked and also guarded by a watchman, and our rooms were also kept securely locked, and we were on a secure top floor. We got back around 12:30, after midnight, and sat in Lee and Brits, also investigators on the Mir case, room for about a half hour talking as Lee emptied his pockets and put his wallet, passport and money on the top of a low wardrobe chest right there beside the bed. There was nothing up there at the time but what he removed from his pockets. It would have been impossible to have missed anything else on there. We finally turned in for the night, and Lee and Britt locked their door and went to bed. At 6:30 next morning, I, having gotten up early, went to Elder's door to get him up for an early breakfast, and knocked. The door was still locked and Lee got up and got his key and unlocked it and let me in while he got dressed. When Lee reached for his wallet and money on the wardrobe, he discovered for the first time, that they were covered over by the big blue folder from the safe of the night before, lying just as it had been in the safe. Britt was awakened by our excitement and observed that blue folder also. Nobody had gotten up and unlocked the door since going to bed the night before. There had been no callers, and the mysterious folder on the wardrobe was only a few feet from the sleepers. Leaving Britt to guard the folder and get dressed, Lee and I went down to a lower level, to a phone, and called the officer. He was dumbfounded upon hearing of the blue folder, and held the line open while he went to the safe and checked. Sure enough, the sensitive blue folder was in fact missing from the safe. He asked us not to touch it, and said he would be right over. He arrived in minutes, with a bodyguard, and removed the folder after insisting on our assurances that we had not looked in it, and asking us to promise not to release this fact for a safe time, which we have done. He was persistent in wanting to know how we had done this, and wasn't quite satisfied with our answer that we did not do it. But this was just one of several such incidents that made believers out of us and maybe him too. At the beginning of that meeting with that same gentleman, in a special suite in the Grosvenor Hotel in London, the residence of several movie stars, and facing Hyde Park, a similar phenomenal event took place that made us begin to wonder who was really in control of what was going on. There had been a build-up to this meeting, with some previous contacts, so we knew where we were going and why. At the beginning of that first interview, we had been received and escorted into the suite used by that gentleman as an office. After that we were taken to a secure room for our discussion, and were just taking our seats. The room was a large one, like a living room, longer than wide, with a picture window on one side and a long sofa on the opposite. To the right of the long sofa was another door with a big desk inside, more chairs and filing cabinets along one wall. In the corner to the right, in front of the long sofa was an executive chair, a big overstuffed chair of black leather with fat arms. At each arm was a side table with a phone on it, white on one side and a red phone on the other. The other seat in the room was a smaller sofa at right angles to the long sofa and also facing the executive chair. The only other piece of furniture there was a large coffee table in front of the long sofa. I took a seat on the far right end of the long sofa, and Lee and Britt took the smaller sofa. We were both facing the big executive seat and were invited to sit down, which we then did. As soon as we were seated, and before any conversation was started, the white phone rang 10 short rings. I was jolted with surprise and I quickly looked at Lee and Britt, who were also looking surprised. Our interviewer had picked up the phone and was trying to get an answer, but apparently there was nobody on the line. Recovering, I asked the gentleman if his phone ever rang like that before. He said it was a strange ring all right, as he was still trying to get an answer on the other end of the line, but now it clearly seemed to be dead. I suggested somebody playing tricks, and he said he could find out, and dialed the operator and asked what happened to the call that just came through. He seemed to have been cut off, he said. No call? Dot. No light on the switchboard. Dot. Could anybody call in on this line without going through the switchboard? Dot. The board would light up and show it. No lights for this room? Dot. No calls into the switchboard in the last 5 minutes? Dot. Thank you. He cleared his throat and turned to start the conversation again, when the red phone rang 10 short rings. He grabbed the phone and quickly answered it as though he would catch the caller this time. Again no answer. This time there was no mistaking the ring. Our interviewer said, I can't believe this. I'll get to the bottom of it right now. This is a direct line right to Telephone Central. It bypasses the switchboard downstairs MeWo's through no other operators. It is a secure line and only especially clear people can use it. He hung the phone up, and then picked it up again and dialed the Telephone Central operator. You did not call? Dot. No calls to this number? Dot. But the phone rang. You did not ring it? Dot. Nobody else can ring it? Dot. No calls came through? Dot. This is very strange. I thank you. Needless to say, our attention was not very well concentrated on the rest of that interview. Then when we inadvertently sanitized our trail and lost the agents he had assigned to us, Not even knowing we had done it, he must have wondered indeed. These situations were only a few of more than a dozen such, of different kinds, which clearly demonstrated to us, with no shadow of a doubt, that the Pleiadians were aware of everything we were doing, as well as everything anybody else was doing that may pertain to them in any way. They alone knew who all the players were. We were able to identify only a few incidentally. The total amount of effort by all must have been spectacular. We already had suspicions of the degree of involvement by others, mostly covert, and could easily see why and how Mia had lost so much of his material. This broad interest was confirmed when a different agent of another country called Lian made an appointment to meet him in a certain small restaurant. Li decided to keep the appointment to see what this man might want. He was surprised to hear the man offer to exchange some of the information we had missed because of its disappearance from Mia's control, the copies of some of the material we got to first which they had missed in their collection efforts. We made a point of not documenting this background maneuvering because we were trying to concentrate on the facts of the extraterrestrial contacts as the phenomenon under study rather than who else might be interested, which had already proved dangerous and we didn't want any more if that. There is no doubt in our minds that some very unusual agency, capable of some remarkable feats of magic was involved, and whatever it was, it had to do with our own investigation of the Pleiades contacts in Switzerland. The 10th contact in the afternoon of the 26th of March 1975, consisted of a long discourse on the nature of spirit, the God within, and its relationship with the all of creation, the fact that the spirit in man is the creator of its own destiny and man's contact with deity. This whole discourse sounded remarkably like the Ramtha dialogues, considering the fact that, although the communicators in both cases said they originated in the Pleiades, they communicated to entirely different groups of people, in different places, at different times, all unknown to each other. They both described a non-personified creation consciousness that ensouls all, and in which all has its being. The creation consciousness is the sum of all its parts, and each part has equal access to the all. In effect, we are all co-creators within the creation, and each has its own direct contact with its God self within. In that sense, each is master of his own destiny and constantly creates his future as he progresses. The future of all is the collective of all the individual futures as they balance out. In the 11th contact on the 15th of April 1975, again in mid-afternoon, Mia is criticized once more for moving too slowly in getting his mission, for which he has been so carefully prepared over such a long time, into motion. He is advised that he needs support and that he should get his friends more involved and organize them into a group effort. When he complains of a lack of resources for such undertakings, he is reminded how they saved his life in the desert of Africa when he was totally without resources, that his training included helping him to find resources where they were scarce. After more discussion, Mia remembered something and asked Samjays about a new sighting observed from his home. Mia, what was it? The evening of the 20th of March, at 19:30 hours? My children and my wife had called me to the window, because they saw, within only about a kilometer of distance, an object of reddish or yellowish colors, flying from north to south. Several neighbors had seen this from the street too and wondered about it. Samjays, this was none of us either, but the event is known to me. It treats of a BEE ship of a race known to us, from a neighboring system to our home planets. It treats of peace-minded beings, who for the sake of expedition, travel through space and to other worlds. Especially the Earth interests them, and so their shining beam ships are frequently seen. Their technologies are not yet as developed as ours, and the creatures are as well rather unconcerned whether they are seen or not. Mia, what sort of beings or characters are they? Samjays, they are human forms, and what is more important, is that they are peace-minded and in contact with us, which unfortunately cannot be said about all who cross through the universe. The 12th contact occurred at 15:11 in the afternoon of the 20th of April 1975, only a half hour after a photo demonstration. Mia had taken pictures of some friends at this site a little earlier in the day, and now in the excitement of another flight demonstration and trying to get as many photos as possible. It appears that he had inadvertently reloaded the film with the pictures of the people on it into his camera and shot photos of the spacecraft on top of the others in what appears to be a series of double exposures. When Mia got the developed slides back and had them printed, he was sure that the Pleiadians had posed their ship over the heads of the people, but in a computer we were able to separate the two pictures into their separate parts and they looked to be double exposures. If they were double exposures, the film frames matched together quite closely, which seems to be something very difficult to do, if not purely by accident. Semjaz asked for the slides for study and did not bring them back. She criticized Mia for trying to get people and the spacecraft in the same picture though, saying that such photos may not be good for certain of those concerned. Mia had brought small boxes and padding as he had been instructed to do, and Semjaz gave him some extraterrestrial mineral specimens she had promised, telling him what each was so he could make me notes to later identify the specimens. While they were doing this, Mia observed that the Pleiades is a so-called open star cluster in Taurus, and asked how many stars they had there in that group. Semjaz answered, some 254. Mia came back to the landing site the following day to examine the tracks, and noticed that an army team was searching the same area and taking samples. They had the landing place marked on their map. He pretended not to be involved and got on his moped and rode away. The 13th contact at 17:20 in the afternoon of the 25th of April 1975, was a short one. Semjaz, the time today is, by regret, very scarce, thus we can only discuss the most important things. For the first, I bring back the loaned book, about which I don't need to express myself more. I refer to the judgment which I have given you in my last contact. Me views have not changed. Mia, I will convey your answer to me friend, and in his name I also thank you for your trouble. Semjaz, it is not worth mentioning, and on the other hand, I am very delighted that your friend wanted my judgment to this book. If all of your friends were as reasonable, confident and friendly, as he, then everything would run better with your mission. I am delighted about your other two friends, though they are some ponderous and objective. This matter is only their thinking, which they first have to educate toward new objectives and new recognitions. Still I can assure them of finding their endeavors, their perceptive faculties and their well-being remarkable. About the other persons in the group I already have spoken in our last meeting, and I do not want to come to that again. The decision is done in this respect, by which it is sufficient. But their whole mind is not well for our undertaking, so I have wondered whether I should destroy the film, which you exposed on Sunday morning of the 20th, at 10 o'clock, in which they were photographed. I have decided to destroy the film as was me your closer friends should not be disappointed for that, as in the tomorrow day, I want to give you one more chance. During the afternoon, to photograph further pictures. I have but to dettle the destination, no disturbing factors there being allowed, such as the mentioned persons represent. Mia, of course I observe your decision, Semjaz, though I pity the destruction of the film. That you offer one more chance for such photographing makes it acceptable again. What now still interests me is another matter. More, and there I can observe UFOs, which, according to their forms, do not belong to you. In most cases the objects are but so very far away, that one cannot see more details, or even photograph them, which doing would be very interesting for comparison. Can I do anything in this respect, to get sometime a chance for photographing? The second question concerns the crystals you have brought me. My friend F.L. was delighted with the green malachite stones. He now asks you whether you could bring him a still greater piece of this same sort of mineral? Semjaz, I regard it very interesting that you pass over the destruction of the film so easily, which is just not your character, because I know very well how much you can become excited if anything does not run as you desire. You pose a riddle in this respect. But you also honor me, that you simply accept my decision. Concerning the strange UFO that you want to expose for a comparison, I myself can do nothing, unfortunately. You well might influence them with your thoughts, concentrated on their flight and light mission, but not in a way that you could command them to come near enough to capture them on film. From my side, I have only a possibility to do so.